Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a couple of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with President Obama's trip today to Wisconsin and discuss the bellwether political battle shaping up in that state, where Governor Walker, who is facing a recall, has declared that a win for him would deliver a devastating blow to Obama's re-election campaign. John Nichols, The Nation magazine's Washington correspondent, joins us from Madison, Wisconsin. He is the author of the new book, just out, Uprising, How Wisconsin Renewed the Politics of Protest from Madison to Wall Street. Then, with tensions rising over assassinations by Iranian operatives and a cutoff of Iranian oil to European customers, which has driven up the price of oil today to $120 a barrel, as well as President Ahmadinejad's announcement of Iran's rapid progress in nuclear enrichment, we will discuss the lack of enthusiasm within the U.S. military for a war with Iran many of the top brass believe would be messy, bloody, unpredictable, and ultimately inconclusive. A Quaker and former conscientious objector turned war correspondent, David Wood, joins us. He has an article at the Huffington Post, Iran's nuclear threat brings no U.S. enthusiasm for a military strike. And joining us now from Wisconsin is John Nichols, who is The Nation magazine's Washington correspondent and the associate editor of The Capital Times, the daily newspaper in Madison, Wisconsin. He and Robert McChesney co-authored It's the Media Stupid and Tragedy and Farce, How the American Media Sells Wars, Spins Elections and Destroys Democracies. His latest book, just out, is Uprising, How Wisconsin Renewed the Politics of Protest from Madison to Wall Street. Welcome to Background Briefing, John Nichols.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
And today in your state, President Obama visited Milwaukee Master Lock and Key Factory, and the governor, Scott Walker, the very controversial governor, had said that he couldn't make the tour of the factory with the president because he had stomach flu. However, he did show up at the airport to greet the president, where he gave him a Milwaukee Brewers baseball jersey that read Obama with the number one on it. So what's going on with the governor? Is he trying to infect the president, give him stomach flu?
I know. Really, the question that everyone should be asking is whether the president brought along hand sanitizer. because it was a bizarre, bizarre moment, because everyone was waiting to see Scott Walker spent the better part of the day with Barack Obama. Walker is a militant critic of Obama. In fact, just last Friday at the Conservative Political Action Conference in Washington, D.C., Walker gave a keynote speech and literally ripped the president on economic issues, on style, on politics. And so the assumption was that this would be a rather tense meeting. Instead, Walker announced this morning that he wouldn't be doing most of the day with Obama, wouldn't be going to the factory because he had stomach flu. Everyone said, well, all right, that's understandable. You're sick, you should stay home. But instead, he says, but I will come to the airport, get the photo opportunity, the picture of the governor with the president, give him this jersey, then I'll take off. As the day went on, Governor Walker also felt healthy enough issue a series of press releases claiming credit for the things that President Obama spoke about at the event. So there was a good deal of skepticism about whether Governor Walker was really sick or whether he was looking at a very difficult circumstance. They were going to be standing in an industrial setting with Obama talking about the national renewal of manufacturing. You know, so, you know, I have to tell you, I think it's very minimal, but some progress toward economic recovery. And Walker had stood next to him facing the reality that under Walker, Wisconsin has not had a manufacturing renewal. And in fact, over the last 6 months, has been the one state in the country that each month has posted job losses. He has a very, very dire economic record. And so my sense is that it was a political choice, that he decided at the last minute that he wanted to have his picture with a popular Democratic president, especially when he's facing a recall election. He did not want to risk the analysis of his policies and what they've done to Wisconsin.
Well, I guess it could have been worse, though. He could have wagged his finger at the president like the governor of Arizona did.
But he was never going to do that. He... The reason that Walker, who's been so harshly critical of Obama when he isn't near Obama and when he isn't in Wisconsin, is because Walker faces a very, very difficult recall election. The voters of Wisconsin have petitioned for his removal. More than a million of them signed those petitions, saying they want a new election to get rid of this governor. And so he's in a very, very vulnerable place, very bad place politically. He polls very poorly among Democrats and independents who lean Democratic. And so the reason he wanted to be around Obama today, or at least get that photograph, is to sort of soften his image as, you know, this kind of draconian figure that Democrats really hate. And so that it was a political games all around, and I think quite transparent, which has tended to be the story of the last year in Wisconsin.
Well, we certainly want to get to that, John, and your new book, Uprising, How Wisconsin Renewed the Politics of Protest from Madison to Wall Street, a book that was released yesterday, Valentine's Day. And the president carried Wisconsin by 14 percentage points in 2008. But then 2 years later, there was something of a Republican sweep led by Governor Scott Walker, capturing nearly every statewide office. Then he overstepped his bounds and created a tremendous backlash with his union busting. And now he's facing this recall election later in the spring or summer, where you mentioned a million signatures, which is way below the threshold necessary. I'm sorry, way above the threshold. But the point here is that Walker himself has already framed this recall election at the CPAC meeting on Friday that where he gave a speech. He's basically saying, Walker's saying to the faithful, the Republican faithful, that if he wins, it could deliver a devastating blow to Obama in his re-election campaign. So is there a flip side to that as well?
Well, there is. I mean, the fact of the matter is that the whole of the United States, not just Wisconsin, but this country is really at a pivotal moment politically. And I think if we can be realistic about it, way beyond politics, going deep into the economics and the basic structures of the country, Americans are going to have to make some fundamental choices over the next year. And those choices really are between an austerity agenda pushed by members of Congress on the Republican side, as well as many Republican governors, and frankly, to be honest, also quite a few Democrats. And that austerity agenda says that we've had some hard times. Maybe even if the economy is getting a little bit better, we still have a lot of debt, a lot of deficits, a lot of challenges. And that as a result, the sacrifices that would be necessary to balance budgets really have to rest on the shoulders of working-class families, working-class communities, and the great mass of Americans. That austerity agenda is a lie. It is basically rooted in the fantasy that everybody is responsible for the difficult economic times that we're in. It's not the case. What we really need is an accountability agenda that holds those political figures, and particularly those corporate figures who profited so mightily over the last decade, to account and say they have to pay their fair share. They have to return at least some measure of the largesse that they absconded with through ridiculous tax breaks, through bank bailouts, and a host of other policies that favored the 1%. And because we're at a point where we're really looking at such choices, when things go one way or the other, it will have meaning. If Wisconsin does not recall and remove Scott Walker, who's made himself the point person in attacks on labor rights, but also on public education, public services, in many ways, the whole of the commons, those elements of our lives that we share together and work together on. Walker's really been quite brutal in his assaults on these things. If he wins, there will be a message that goes out from Wisconsin, and the message will be that Republican governors, and again, I think many Democrats, can and should go even more aggressively in the direction of that austerity agenda. By the same token, if Walker is defeated by this popular movement that has risen up first in the streets and then with a renegade politics of recall and aggressive challenges to the sitting governor, not at the next election, but at the demand of the people. If that politics wins, then the message from Wisconsin will be a very different one. It will say that that accountability agenda has real potential and that it can shift the electoral direction of a state and maybe a nation very, very quickly. So there's big deal stuff at stake. And for better or worse, Wisconsin has become the center of this debate. The Wall Street Journal, not exactly a liberal operation, suggests that the Wisconsin recall election is the second most important political test of 2012, second only to the presidential race. And I frankly think that there are a lot of Republicans and even a good many Democrats who agree with that.
Again, I'm speaking with John Nichols, who is the Nation Magazine's Washington correspondent and the associate editor of the Capital Times, a daily newspaper in Madison, Wisconsin. He's the author of a brand new book just out, Uprising, How Wisconsin Renewed the Politics of Protest from Madison to Wall Street. So given what you've just told us, John, how high the stakes are for both the Republicans and for President Obama and the Democrats, then I imagine money's going to pour in, right, on both sides. We already know that Governor Walker he has super PACs already, doesn't he?
Oh, yeah. Look, Governor Walker is raising money at this point at a rate of roughly $5 million a month. That's $5 million a month. To put that in perspective, we thought it was an incredibly big deal when a Las Vegas billionaire gave Newt Gingrich $5 million early on in this process to try and renew his candidacy. That was front page news. It was a really big deal. So the governor's raising that every month, and it's coming not from Wisconsinites. It's coming from outside the state. 61% of his donations in his most recent filing came from Texas, Florida, New York, K Street in Washington, and other places outside Wisconsin. So he's bringing in a great deal of money. It's going to be essentially the political equivalent of nuclear war in Wisconsin once this recall gets going. Walker will have immense amounts of money, and those who challenge him are likely to have at least a reasonable amount of money. It won't be as much, but organized labor has recognized that this really is a life and death battle. And I think you will see, substantial spending there. At the end of the day, though, Walker won't be beaten by money. The only way that Governor Walker will be defeated is if this mass movement that's risen up, a movement that literally put hundreds of thousands of people in the streets a year ago this week, and that then has raised this million signatures for the recall. If that movement takes its people power, aims it in the right direction, there were 30,000 volunteers actively involved in the recall petitioning, for instance. That's a powerful counter to money power. And I think one of the most frustrating things, and it's something I write about in the book, is the lie that many Americans tell themselves that the money really does have to overwhelm everything. Money's very, very powerful. It's dramatically too powerful in our politics. But Saul Alinsky, the guy that Newt Gingrich always picks on, was actually right. There is one thing that, in American history at least, and hopefully still today, can beat amalgamated money power, and that is amalgamated people power. When people are organized, when they get out and do things, they can accomplish great ends. And so the Wisconsin fight, in addition to being a great test on these labor issues, a great test on the austerity issue, is also going to be a real test on whether people power can challenge money power.
And John Nichols, in terms of this titanic battle that's coming up in the spring or the summer to recall Scott Walker, he's clearly the face on the Republican side, but on the recall side, do they have a face? Do they need a face? You say they need people power, but presumably when you recall a governor, you're going to replace him with someone.
That's right. And it's a challenge that we have in our politics. Our politics is so personality-driven that we frequently lose sight of the issues and think, oh, you've got to have a person. I think that in Wisconsin, it's very important that the recall process, which grew out of a non-electoral street-based activist demonstration and protest politics, be careful about too deeply into that personality zone, the issue has to be in the forefront. It has to be front and center. And that means the recall election has to be about Scott Walker's attack on working people, on their communities, their schools. That's got to be what it's about. But, of course, you have to have somebody who can carry that message. And so on the Democratic side, there will be a candidate, and that candidate will be a prominent player from Democratic politics in Wisconsin, more likely than not. And at this point, I can't tell you who it will be because we haven't even scheduled the recall election yet. That's still in a process of review of the signatures and challenges by the governor. He's trying to delay things as long as he can. He's a subject of a John Doe investigation into criminal corruption related to his 2010 campaign. Not the governor. I should say the governor's campaign is the subject of that. We don't know if the governor personally is going to end up being drawn in, but I mean that's a big deal. So he's had a lot of negative headlines recently, and he'd like to delay the process for as long as he can. Ultimately, though, once the review of the signatures is complete and the election is scheduled, then there'll be a timeline. It's at that point that it will be critical for Democrats to stand up. They can have a primary, and my sense is that it is very possible that people will see a very prominent Democrat, perhaps a current or former member of Congress or the Senate, stepping in, perhaps another figure. You know, certainly there are plenty of state legislators who are already talking about running, some county officials. You know, consider your mid-level political players, and I think that any number of them probably could carry the message, but I don't rule out the prospect that someone as prominent as a former Senator Russ Feingold might yet be talked into running, although Feingold's been very resistant. He has not leapt to the race, but you know, I think this is such an intense moment and such a remarkable political opening, if you will, a chance to really do something very different than what we've seen in other states and in most of our national politics, and a chance to fuse this politics of protest, this real challenging of the austerity agenda, with a more traditional electoral politics that I hope that the Democrats recognize this and seize on it and run in the right way. It shouldn't be a very traditional campaign. Nothing about what's happened in Wisconsin over the last year has followed standard current political patterns. It's been much more exciting, much more vibrant, and I think that a boring, predictable politics would be a bad idea. Democrats could still lose this race. It is entirely possible that even with all this people power, you could lose. But I think that the way to win is unquestionably to color outside the lines, to have sort of an outside-the-boundaries campaign. I think Feingold might be somebody who could do that, but there are also several other candidates who could probably fill the bill.
Again, I'm speaking with John Nichols, who is the Nation Magazine's Washington correspondent and associate editor of Capital Times, a daily newspaper in Madison. He's the author of the brand new book, Uprising, How Wisconsin Renewed the Politics of Protest from Madison to Wall Street. So let's get into the book. And just to finish up on Walker, you mentioned his campaign's in trouble. A couple of his key aides have been interviewed by the FBI. I don't know where indictments stand, but
there have been some felony charges. And these have been to people very close to the governor. So that's a real issue.
And then, but the issue just came up is that the this paltry $26 billion for the people with distressed mortgages and who have been victims of bank fraud. The money that was agreed with all the state's attorney generals is, of course, a drop in the bucket compared to the, $800 billion or so in terms of real losses. But apparently, Wisconsin's share of that $26 billion, most of which goes to California and Florida, the governor says it's going to go into balancing the budget. It's not going to go to the victims of the massive Wall Street subprime fraud.
Isn't that mind-blowing? I mean, it's, you know, when that happened just a few days ago, I was sort of, in a jaw-dropped moment. I don't get that way very much about politics, but here you have a guy who's made such a big deal, like many of these Republican governors, about the fact that he's going to do really tough things to balance budgets. And once you get some balance, then, you know, you're going to have opportunity to have growth and to move forward. Well, Walker has done a lot of tough things. He's backed unions, public schools, public services, and gotten most of his way on a number of issues. And yet, the economy is actually worse than it was when he started, in by a number of measures. And now he has a new budget deficit. And he's fundamentally dishonest about this. A year ago, when he had $137 million budget deficit, he said that was such a crisis that he needed to take away collective bargaining rights, undermine the civil service, and in a whole number of other ways, change the state of Wisconsin. And that's what caused all the demonstrations, the hundreds of thousands of people in the street last year. This year, he's got $143 million shortfall, a little bit more than what he had last year. And he says, oh, it's not a big deal. I will take care of it by shifting some money around. And then to make the choice of shifting money from a federal fund set up to, or a federally organized fund set up to relieve the mortgage stress on low-income people and their neighborhoods, he takes the money out of that rather than dialing back some of the dramatic tax cuts that he's given to wealthy people and corporations. It's almost, if you wanted to see the embodiment of what Occupy Wall Street is about, why Occupy Wall Street was needed, why it's become such a force in America, it's because it's shined the light of day on policies like this, approaches like this. Not just bad policy, but literally an immoral policy that robs from the poor and gives to the rich. It does every once in a while cause even so cynical a reporter as myself to be a bit shocked.
Well, just in closing, John Nichols, what struck me immediately was the numbers of people and how often they came out and how persistent they were. And these were ordinary folks. These weren't, you know, your regular demonstrators, you know, who show up in handfuls usually. This was a vast cross-section of people. And I'm wondering whether it could be translated into a national uprising, to use your title. I mean, there's so many great stories in your book. I also, because it's my namesake, I love the story of Ian's Pizza's house right next to the Capitol, where they delivered thousands of pizzas to the demonstrations on behalf of callers from all 50 states, but also from as far away as Antarctica and from Egypt, in the middle of Egypt. revolution.
You're exactly right.
That gives you great heart.
The day I've talked to the Ian's people, I write about it a little bit in the book. The day that they got the call from the union representing the Suez Canal workers, saying, you know, we want to lay our credit card down and send some pizzas to the Capitol. I mean, that was just, I don't see how you can't be, almost a little giddy. Because we've talked for an awfully long time, those of us, people like you, I hope people like me, about the need for international solidarity, the need to look across borders and make connections with people who may not have exactly the same experiences as we do, but who share the same desires and also face many of the same challenges. And when Wisconsinites took a cue from Egyptians and went to their square and occupied it just as Egyptians had right before the Wisconsin struggle, and then to have the Egyptians come back and indicate their support, it was, you know, you're coming full circle there in some ways. And the Ian's Pizza story is a wondrous one. It shows how passionately people around the country wanted to support what was going on in Wisconsin. But there's a thousand stories like that, stories of, you know, rockers like Tom Morello, you know, trudging through the snow to get to the demonstrations in Wisconsin, and of people from around Wisconsin just giving themselves to this movement. People who never have been involved in anything political before suddenly becoming intensely and constantly political. And you know, I've been in places around the world that have been in transformational moments before. South Africa in the early 1990s. Middle East at many key points, both in Palestine and in other countries of that region, and Israel itself. And so I've seen intense moments and intensely political times. What happened in Wisconsin in February and March, and to many extents what continues to happen to this day, is one of those moments where everybody's talking about what's going on and where huge numbers of people are highly engaged and won't let go, won't stop. And that's where change comes from. Change doesn't ever come from a president. It never comes from somebody with a lot of money, at least not change for the better. Change for the better comes from the bottom up, and it comes when great masses of people decide that they're going to become highly engaged and stay engaged until they get what they want. It's happening in Wisconsin. I think you're seeing some of it happen in states like Ohio. There are real movements building up in Arizona to challenge anti-labor and anti-immigrant laws down there. And, you know, what we do need to do is start to weave all these movements together, to connect them, to tell them that they should remain rooted in their place. They don't have to give up their passion for the core issues that they're fighting on. But as they move out of that place, you know, they ought to connect with people in other states, both for the strength that their allies in other places can give, but also for the lessons that they can teach. If we do this right, I think we can have a new politics of protest that is less about elections and more about holding the elected to account. If we get there, I think we can nationalize things, and I think we can also begin to talk about movements that matter and that don't always get diverted into, you know, electing the lesser of two evils, and remain in the streets, remain pressing power for the better of many good.
Well, John Nichols, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
It's been a great pleasure, Ian, and I wish you luck with challenges that lay ahead, because this station and your show are really a vital part of a national conversation, a national dialogue that keeps these issues in the forefront. So I very much appreciate you.
Well, thank you again, John Nichols, who's the Nation magazine Washington correspondent. He's associate editor of the Capital Times, the daily newspaper in Madison, Wisconsin. And he and Robert McChesney co-authored It's the Media, Stupid, and Tragedy and Farce, How the American Media Sells War, Spins Elections, and Destroys Democracy. His latest book just out is Uprising, How Wisconsin Renewed the Politics of Protest from Madison to Wall Street. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking to a Quaker and a conscientious objector who became a war correspondent.